So my job is made a lot easier by the three speakers who preceded me. As Barbara was going through her talk, I could easily have started deleting slides. You'll see some considerable overlap. I'm going to discuss high PT hadrons and nuclear medium effects from the star perspective. In fact, there's some new data here which have not been presented before, so I'll spend some time talking about some experimental details to give you some idea of their content and address really the same kind of questions that Barbara was addressing. What really have we learned from these data? I'll arrive at the same conclusions, maybe from a slightly different route. I'll show the inclusive charge hadron spectra. These are new data, haven't yet been shown in public, the centrality dependence. Elliptic flow has been shown in the past, but I'll go through that again. This is quite important. And there are new results on two-particle correlations at high PT. Is this working? Actually, I prefer laser. Let me do that. So this, actually, I think Microsoft is going to distribute this in their next PowerPoint distribution. I'm pleased to learn this comes from Axel. You should put your name on the bottom. These things have a life of their own. They migrate from talk to talk. So this has been gone through many times. I'll just run through it quickly. The initial rates, and what's interesting about hard probe in general, high Q squared probes, the initial rates are calculable from PQCD with a few caveats, principally about shadowing. Because it's at high Q squared, the processes occur early in time and probe the hot and dense phase, which is, of course, what we're after. And the signature of, and basically what we're doing is probing the soft physics, the bulk physics with hard probes. And what we're after is an interaction of these hard probes with the surrounding matter. And the two examples we've been talking about, really the only two that exist in our field, are photonic energy loss of the bare color charge quark and then quarkonium dissociation. So one has some generic hard process occurring early within the medium, the stuff interacts and we want to look at the products. But of course it needs some calibration, which we've already been discussing, to do with so-called Cronin or initial state multiple scattering and shadowing and so on. So first of all, what about cold matter? I won't go through this. We heard about this in detail from Shinyan. There are actually a couple of ways of getting at energy loss in cold hadronic matter, cold nuclear matter. Shinyan showed this calculation. And for a 10 GeV quark, he deduces a DDX of about a half a GeV per Fermi. And there's some analysis of Drellian production. It turns out one should go actually to older data where you're actually probing higher X pi A data from NA3 at CERN, and Arlio deduced a rather small energy loss for an incoming 50 GeV quark. So these are somewhat consistent and give you an idea of the general scale of energy loss for cold matter. So what about jets and heavy ion collisions? Well, first of all, this is what a jet looks like at LEP. This is what a jet looks like at RIC. And you won't find it there. I'm actually not sure there's a jet in this event, and that's exactly the point. We can't do full jet reconstruction on heavy ion events. The so-called underlying event, just the background, is overwhelming. This is a central event of maximal multiplicity, of course. That's the worst case. So what we have to sort of back off and do ISR-type physics, but ISR did wonderful high PT physics, and there's a good pedigree. We look, first of all, at leading particles, Phoenix and Star both together, and the next step is to look at correlations, the correlations of two leading particles, which is actually my third topic for today, and then there's this whole question of flow and the whole topology of the event. So this actually comes back to a discussion we had yesterday, an elementary experimental fact. What happens when you ask for a heavy ion event that has a high PT track in it? So what we see here, first of all, the black histogram, is just the charge, it's a probability distribution to get a certain number of charged particles in the star TPC. So this is the usual distribution. The most peripheral collisions have the highest cross-section, and then there's this is all well understood and completely dominated by geometry. Now we ask for events that have at least one charged particle that has 2 GeV transverse momentum, and you get a biased distribution in the charged particles. And that's shown by the red curve. We then ask for a distribution of the charged particle probability for events with a 4 GeV track, you get the green curve. And so you see, as you ask for higher and higher transverse momentum, you're biasing towards more and more central events. And this, of course, is the way binary collisions go. That can be understood by elementary nuclear collisions, but it doesn't have to be that way. This is, in fact, just a consequence of any steeply falling PT distribution. So this is an experimental bias one needs to keep in mind. It doesn't necessarily prove that we're looking at binary collision scaling as we go to higher PT, unless as we raise this threshold higher than what we have, we see this bias sort of saturate, and I think that starts to be evidence. We're really looking at the fragments of jets as we go to higher and higher PT. So I'll actually come back to this. It's an important slide. So let me turn to my first physics topic of inclusive hadron distributions. And we have a rather wide PT range, going from 100 MeV up to 6 GeV. And this is, well, this analysis has been in the works for some time. This is the final but one. We have some small correction to do still, but this is the almost final analysis for charged hadrons for the 130 GeV data. New to this presentation, we haven't yet shown estimates for the full centrality spectrum for the number of binary collisions and the number of participants, and I'll discuss a bit how we do that. Basically, we use the standard procedure of equating intervals of total cross-section in a Glauber model and an experimental observable. In our case, the experimental observable is a charged particle multiplicity at mid-rapidity. So that should give you pause for a moment. For our year one data, we actually did not have forward tracking, so we couldn't do the equivalent of the other experiments, BBCs. We used the distribution I showed on that slide showing the event bias, the charged particle distribution showing the bias as you raise the PT cut. And an initial reaction is one of worry. This is where we're measuring the signal. Are we subject to autocorrelations? And this actually came up in Witt's talk yesterday. The answer is, in fact, no. This procedure of equating fractions of cross-section is really robust against a number of biases which we have looked at. One can try different scaling of the charged particle generation with number of participants, number of binary collisions, some admixture of the two, looking at multiplicity fluctuations. One of the great concerns we had was in this region, again, coming precisely back to Dima's question, if you have jets, if you have a jet here, for fixed geometry, you may bias the multiplicity distribution. We can look at that in the star acceptance by looking in the same phase space as a high PT particle and away from it and studying this distribution for those two cases. And one sees a small bias, but it's actually extremely small. So the answer to Dima's question about multiplicity bias due to the presence of jets is that for the most peripheral bin here, it is in fact an observable effect, but very tiny, basically equivalent to about a 1% error resolution on the total cross-section. So I don't have time to go into all the details, but I think we feel confident that this is a reasonable method, a reliable method to give us number of binary and number of participants in each centrality bin. Of course, the long-term way out of this is actually to measure, this is at least for hard probes, again, coming back to a discussion yesterday, is to measure central collisions for different mass AA. So the uncertainty is the number of binary collisions and the number of participants is really minimized if we're comparing the central collisions of different mass. Another ingredient we need for this discussion is a nucleon-nucleon reference. And again, we use this factor RAA, which is the ratio of the measured yields in the nuclear collision over, as Barbara explained, an estimate of the nucleon-nucleon cross-section times some geometric factor, which incorporates this number of binary collisions. We do it slightly different than Phoenix. We don't incorporate the ISR data. We take the UA1 PBARP data and extrapolate downwards. This was also a component of the Phoenix estimate. These estimates, until recently, differed only by 10%, so that was not a major issue. Actually, it's been a long story to get this right. There are some acceptance issues about UA1 versus what STAR and Phoenix measure. I think ultimately, we, as Barbara said, we need to measure PP by ourselves in order to relieve all these uncertainties. But I think at the moment, we have the best we can. These are the inclusive spectra. For the moment, showing only the statistical errors for these centrality bins. The lines are power law fits, and I'll just describe them briefly. So this is the say, PQCD-inspired power law function. And if we fit to the spectra, these are the centrality dependencies of the various parameters. So this gives you a first sense of how the shapes of the spectra are varying as a function of centrality. And the rightmost bin here is for our nucleon-nucleon reference. So you see, for instance, the power, which was used in the first talk this afternoon, the power very smoothly from the most central data to the most peripheral data, and then really attaches quite nicely onto the nucleon-nucleon reference. Now that P0 and N are really highly correlated, so one should really just look at one of these. And again, one can ask, well, how do we really know we're looking at hard scattering? How do we know that there isn't a hydro component here? And we asked a very simple question. We didn't do a full sort of hydro study like Phoenix did, but you can ask, well, if you have a hydro source, and this was thanks to some discussions with Uli, if you have a hydrodynamic, dynamically expanding source, can you, with reasonable source parameters, describe this kind of concave spectrum? Or is this so concave that it really rules out any kind of reasonable hydrodynamic source out here at the highest PT that we measure? Well, it turns out, and this formula is familiar from hydrodynamics, if you have a source at some temperature and you boost it by a velocity, it just gets blue shifted like so, and the red line I've drawn here is just this temperature, 170 MeV, boosted by a velocity of 0.75, and you see it's nicely tangent to the spectra, even out here at 5.5 GeV. So I think one can always find some kind of hydrodynamic source distribution that will reproduce this kind of shape.
That is not convincing. What people showed before, it showed the whole spectrum, not just slope somewhere.
Oh, you need a source distribution. This is kind of the tail, the most extreme component of the velocity distribution.
I would say temperature.
Yeah, okay, you reduce the temperature increasingly. This is simply a proof of principle that one can find some kind of ballpark figures. So my essential conclusion is that the inclusive spectra really don't by themselves exclude hydro. One needs to appeal to correlations, basically, to see where you are. So coming now to the leading hadron spectra themselves and comparing to the nucleon-nucleon distributions, again, these plots have been shown. This is from PA. This is a parameter alpha, which if you translate it into the ratio of PA over AA over PP would give an enhancement factor of about 1.7. That's what an alpha of 1.1 would be for heavy nucleus. So this is from PA. These are the so-called Cronin data, and these SPS data have already been discussed. So these are the centrality bins over the nucleon-nucleon reference I described. We actually separate out the experimental errors into their different components and plot it semi-log so you can see what their various influences are. The errors on the points, which are visible only out here, are the statistical errors only for the moment on the spectra themselves. The caps on the points are the quadrature sum of those errors and the error on the nucleon-nucleon reference. And then the errors on our geometry determination on n binaries are given by the shaded bands here. They're an overall scaling. What you see at low PT, first of all, so RIA is defined such that scaling with the number of binary collisions gives RIA of unity. And scaling with the number of participants, which is seen for the total multiplicity, is going to give an RIA somewhat lower. That's a line mark here. And you see at low PT, where the cross-section is high, indeed, the spectra scale at various centralities with the number of participants, and certainly within errors. As you go up in PT, the ratio relative to the nucleon-nucleon reference climbs, then turns over and comes down again. This is consistent with the data we showed at Quark Matter, and is consistent with the Phoenix observation of suppression of hadron production in central collisions relative to a nucleon-nucleon reference. So I think this really establishes the phenomenon of hadron suppression in nuclear collisions. You see from these data the development of this phenomenon as a function of centrality. As you go to more and more peripheral collisions, the suppression gets less and less. Eventually you arrive at one. One would look for some kind of Cronin enhancement here, within the errors given by the nucleon-nucleon reference and the geometric scaling, you really can't claim any kind of enhancement here. It could be there at the few tens of percent level. We can't tell from this particular analysis. To get away from the uncertainties in the nucleon-nucleon reference, you can compare, as Phoenix has done, the central data to the peripheral data. This is now the most central bin on the previous slide to the second most peripheral, so 0 to 5% over 40 to 60%. And again, these gray bands indicate the uncertainty in the geometric scaling between these two bins. And you again see the most central data are suppressed by some considerable amount, more so compared to the most peripheral bin. And let me make a point here that, again, coming back to this issue of hydro or not out here, this number, both from Phoenix and from STAR, is impressive. It's 2, 3, 4, a not small suppression of hadron yields at high PT. It's a large number. It's a small number. It's a small number in the following sense. These spectra are falling by 5 orders of magnitude over this PT range. And what we are seeing is a rather small modification of the hadron yields over a really tremendous range in cross-section. So that speaks to me and it says this is really hard processes plus some rather modest modification to what's going on to give a small number change of nucleon-nucleon cross-sections times some trivial geometric scaling, which would move this guy up to here. Remember the tremendous change in the yields going from low PT to high PT. Let me address now the one more topic on the inclusive spectra. This is the question of apparent baryon enhancement at, or measured baryon enhancement in the 2 to 3 GeV range. This is the Phoenix plot showing the excess of protons over pions in that range. STAR has anti-lambdas measured. These are given by the, well, there's the STAR protons, the open circles, and the Phoenix protons, or the X's, and the STAR lambda bars. And you see in this PT range that the lambda bars are competitive with the P bars. So it's not just P bar enhancement, it's overall baryon enhancement, not unexpected. But then we also have, as you saw from John's talk yesterday, other measured species. And for instance, here is a comparison, really done in the same way, of the K minus yield versus the phi yield. The phi has a mass compatible with the, or of the same order as the nucleon. And again, you see the same kind of phenomenon, that the phi has a harder slope and is starting to overtake the mesons in the same PT range. So this appears to be a mass effect, not some kind of baryon enhancement effect or other kinds of, I think that argues more towards more conventional mechanisms such as radial flow rather than more exotic baryon junction mechanisms. Let me turn now to my second topic, azimuthal anisotropy. This again has been talked about by several people. We consider non-central collisions, and the reaction zone has some aspect ratio. It has some asymmetry to it. If the system expands via interactions, via multiple collisions, it's going to develop some pressure. This is initially in the coordinate space. Eventually, if it expands with multiple interactions, it will generate an asymmetry in momentum space. This is the general elliptic flow phenomenon. What's interesting at high PT is the following. If this event, the bulk event, which has an asymmetry to it, also happens to have a jet inside it, a priori, the orientation of the jet is not correlated in any way with the orientation of the reaction plane. If, however, there is some kind of energy loss, some interaction of the jet or its products with the surrounding medium, you may actually generate a correlation of the jet products with the orientation of the reaction plane. So that's what we're looking for. It's simply a path length argument. Partonic energy loss may lead to finite so-called V2 at high PT. These are predictions from the initial paper that discussed this from Miklos, Ivan, and Shinyan. And you see this was a kind of a stapling of hydrodynamic calculation with a PQCD calculation out here, and you see the basic prediction depending upon the gluon density of finite V2 at high PT. They didn't consider transverse expansion. They did that in a later paper. That will dilute this effect by some factor. These are two different geometric models, I think, Hart cylinder and Wood-Saxon. Right?
That was not really a prediction.
A post-diction.
The prediction was a hygiene, which if you thought the original hygiene had nothing, right? Basically, in this case.
I leave that for you to look at. Here are the data, first of all, for the prediction is for minimum bias collisions. This is now the data for minimum bias collisions shown with statistical and systematic errors. You see the hydrodynamic, pure hydrodynamics is given by this black line. And as we've shown before, below 2 GeV, hydrodynamics describes the data rather well. The data peel away at higher PT, but they show no evidence of coming back to the axis. You would expect zero V2 in the presence of negligible energy loss. The data show a plateau at high PT. One can try to approach this problem from a different starting point. This is what Dinesh Molnar and Miklós Gyulasi did with a parton transport calculation. They're able to describe the minimum bias V2, but they require enormous initial gluon densities, many times the initial state predicted by Heijing, or basically unphysical gluon-gluon cross-sections, unphysically large. So this, So this is an indication that that something unusual is required to reproduce these data. We now have the centrality dependence in three centrality bins. For the most central, this was already discussed during John's talk, most central, a mid-centrality, and the most peripheral, you see the plateau for all centrality bins, and in fact, the V2 is largest for the most peripheral data. So this is a bit curious. How can that be? Are the V2 and the suppression of inclusives consistent? The suppression of inclusives is smallest for the most peripheral bins, whereas the V2 is largest. Let me remind you of this so-called bias plot. In fact, the most peripheral bin is 34% to 85%, and we're asking for, I missed the essential issue here of what we are doing. What we are doing is asking for high PT tracks correlated with the bulk of the reaction plane, bulk of the event. You ask for a particle with 5 GeV transverse momentum, and you ask how is it correlated with the reaction plane as determined by all particles below 2 GeV. So this is fundamentally different from the two-particle correlation that Barber described, where you're looking at two high PT particles. So this is a correlation of the high PT track with the bulk of the event. And the bulk of the event, as you go, so as you go up in PT, because of this bias, we're actually asking for more and more central events. Because V2 is weighted by the n charge d eta, intrinsic in its definition, in fact, we're comparing this bin should actually be considered as a the relevant geometry is in this region rather than in the more peripheral region. So effectively, the geometry is changing as you go from low PT to high PT. This is a fact that's not always appreciated or understood. Theory comparisons really need to take this into account. By weighting by the n charge theta. Coming back to this question of mesons versus baryons at high PT, this is a prediction from Miklós and company. If indeed there are some unusual dynamics going on in the baryon sector, one might see this in V2, where the proton V2 could be large, the pions somewhat smaller. If the mesons are dominated by PQCD energy loss effects, whereas the baryons are dominated by hydroflow, one might see a different flow in the different elliptic flow in the two cases. These are the data we have so far from year one. While again, this is for K0 shorts and for lambdas, you see the agreement with hydrodynamic calculations at low PT. We simply don't have the PT reach for the year one data in these two observables. This will have to wait till next year. Let me turn to the last topic of two particle correlations. This is a new analysis. We take particles that have transverse momentum above 4 GeV within the star TPC, and we look at the azimuthal correlations of all other particles in the event above 2 GeV. This is, I think, analogous to what Phoenix has done in their correlation analysis. There are various sources of correlations that will come into this distribution. Short range in eta, you'll have jets, which have an eta range below of order 0.5 or so, and you'll also have long range elliptic flow. If you go to large eta between the two, the trigger particle and the one you're correlating, you will be sensitive only to the elliptic flow, and the jet component will die away. Basically, we're going far away from phase space from the trigger particle in order to isolate the elliptic flow component and subtract that to see whether we have anything left that we can attribute to jets. Note that this procedure, the filled points are the correlation function constructed like that for the short range of delta eta between the two particles less than 0.5, whereas the open points correspond to delta eta greater than 0.5. These are the two plots on this, on the upper panel. Lower panel is the difference between them, and you see the difference between the short range and the long range has a peak centered at zero. So there's an enhanced probability if you have one particle at 4 GeV, to have a second one in its vicinity in azimuth on short range in eta. This is, in fact, a jet-like correlation, and it's the first indication of jets and RIC. By construction, taking away the large eta component takes away the back-to-back by construction of our method. Let's compare to UA1. UA1 did a similar measurement, happens to have exactly the same kinematic cuts. This is the UA1 distribution, slightly higher, somewhat higher energy, larger eta acceptance, but I think these are directly comparable. This is the correlation. You see the back-to-back component in the UA1 data. This is the same side correlation. The UA1 data here is the star correlation. You see just the first look at this correlation, but you see within the precision of this measurement, the widths of the correlations are compatible. One can also look at this in Hijing. Hijing are the red points. The star data are superimposed. And you see, of course, a correlation peak in Hijing. We do exactly the same procedure, and so the wayside component is taken away in the Hijing calculation. But you see again that the width of the correlation peak in the star data is really compatible with that in Hijing. One can actually look at Hijing with and without fragmentation. You see no effect, but Xinyan says that, in fact, one shouldn't expect that. There is no effect in Hijing on fragmentation due to quenching at present. One can actually discuss whether that should be put in. Yeah, it's done precisely the same way, so you don't see the wayside. So let me review the three main points of the star high PT data. The first is the centrality dependence of the inclusive production compared to the nucleon-nucleon reference. You see the large suppression for central data, and eventually that suppression goes away for the most peripheral. For the elliptic flow correlating a high PT particle with the reaction plane from the rest of the event, we see large correlation at the highest PTs we can measure for all centralities. And it's a little curious that if you draw a line at 2 GeV, I've drawn a very suggestive line here, something qualitative seems to change between the low PT part and the high PT part, and something around 2 GeV seems to be about the right scale where things change. For the inclusive spectra at low PT, all of the spectra compared to the nucleon-nucleon reference are really very similar. At high PT, there's a fundamental difference. And again, we've seen first evidence for jet-like structures at RIC. So what have we learned? Below 2 GeV, and again, this comes back to really very similar to what Barbara concluded, below about 2 GeV, hydrodynamics seems to provide a rather good description of what's going on. Above 4 GeV, it appears to fail. We see it fails in the V2. I don't think that hydro can generate the kind of two near-side two-particle correlations that we've observed. Hydro fails.
What part of spectrum is this correlation? It may be tiny correlation.
It's about, we'll come back to that in the discussion period. And hydro fails and PQCD starts to dominate. I think overall we've really seen from the two experiments strong evidence for in-medium interactions at high PT.
How PQCD can be dominant if you produce half baryons? And PQCD produces zero baryons.
Nobody knows what the baryon yield is in this range. However, so as has been stressed several times, what we're after is a measurement of the gluon density in the soft matter. We aren't yet there. We haven't shown that this is jet quenching. We're on our way to showing that we're actually looking at jets, but we also need to disentangle the initial and the final state effects. But it seems to me we also have an answer to a key question, that is, what really is interacting in the medium? And it's a question of how the fragmentation factorizes from the rest of the scattering. Are we looking at the interaction of partons in the medium or fragmentation hadrons, and what experiment can we do to tell that? And maybe these two-particle correlations that I've shown in the last part of my talk are the key to that. They are kind of our window into the fragmentation function. And if we map these as a function of transverse momentum and centrality, and maybe, as Shinyoung pointed out, really constrain the Q squared of the collision with a gamma jet coincidence, we can really, with some precision, tell what really is interacting in the medium and what the energy loss is. So just a quick look what's coming next from STAR. Year two, we have about 10 times statistics of year one. We'll get well above 10 GeV. I think that's a standard number. Much more detailed study of what I've shown you. We have PP reference data that's coming. We'll have pi zeros from the calorimeter. The deuteron goal, the proton goal, looks more likely deuteron goal, is really a key measurement that all of us need to push. I think lighter ions, in order to nail this geometry problem, lighter ions are really quite important for the RIC program as well. And there's a long program of high PT ahead of us. Thank you.
You showed very interesting data on the jet-like structure. Your procedure, artificially, as you explained, removes back-to-back correlations. But did you try to look if they really exist in the data or not?
Well, the problem is they're not distinguishable from you can see it here. This is the open distribution. You see, and an essential point is from the long-range correlations, you can extract the V2. It's entirely consistent with the V2 we get from the reaction plane method. So back-to-back jets are not, in principle, distinguishable from overall elliptic flow.
Yep. The point here is that it's an extremely important point because, for example, in the saturation picture, you can have a jet, monojet, which will not have anything back-to-back. So it's a very interesting thing to explore. I mean, this back-to-back jet correlation.
Yeah, the problem is if you have finite acceptance in eta, that the dijet can go, the correlation length in eta for a dijet is very long. And you cannot exclude, unless you have very large acceptance, you cannot exclude that there's a dijet. You really need to have large coverage for that. Yeah. Yeah, one could look at it would be a quantitative question of cross sections. Yeah, fine.
I have an experimental question to this picture. What does it look like in mixed events?
I don't know the answer to that, but Carol.
I mean, it's not a mixed event analysis. Yeah. What you do here. I mean, like one like systematic check which we did. This feeds to the correlation function requiring a pseudo rapidity gap. If you select particles in the region from 2 to 6 GeV and you do your two particle correlation analysis and fit with V2 function, you get exactly identical result as in your V2 analysis with respect to the reaction plane for all three, for these three different centralities. So what you actually, when you require a gap between two particles when you correlate them, you're actually looking at the true long-range correlations. And then you just recover V2 from your reaction plane analysis. If you were to fit this distribution with a cosine-like function without like removing this jet-like structure at near zero, then you would, of course, overestimate your V2. And it's not a mixed event. Like we don't have to. This is direct correlation function, which we don't subtract any. We don't construct any mixed events.
Yeah, along the same lines, I'd like to say I think this is great stuff, very intriguing and exciting, but I have to ask you all the nasty questions about this sort of thing could be generated by, you know, variations in your efficiency as a function of phi. It could be generated by weak decays. It could be generated by resonance decays. It could be generated by photon conversions. I assume you've looked at all these things because yes, I know absolutely. You and you're a very thorough guy, but you want to talk about what went into other possible sources for near
You're
correlations.
Doing fine. What is what? Yeah, that's statistical. I mean, I don't know what you want to be. Yes, we've checked all those things. The tracks are long so that we aren't, I mean, one thing you worry about is track splitting. You have one track which appears as two in your detector, and so we have long tracks to prevent that. So all of these things have gone into this analysis, and this is not due to resonances or, I mean, talk offline.
Yeah, I'd like to get some comment about this explanation by Kovchikov and Tuchin of the high PT stuff. And since Tuchin's here, and since you just gave a talk about it and you didn't mention Kovchikov and Tuchin, it'd be interesting to see what you think.
Right. Yeah, well.
Okay, Yuri Kovchikov and me calculated V2 from correlations of two mini jets in heavy ion collisions. We used the fact that gluon fields in heavy nuclei are almost classical, and we used saturation stuff and calculated, and our result gives the saturation in V2 as a PT as a function of PT, almost at up to 6 GeV, and also we predicted correct centrality dependence for most central events, and have good description of V2 for centrality beams.
The physical origin of the correlation is due entirely to diejets. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And if we separate the delta eta.
No. Wait, it's two different analyses. This is for the V2, I assume. This is for this calculation.
Yeah. I have no picture about that because we are calculating right now. But preliminary results is that we can explain all this.
Well, but the question is whether you are calculating what we actually do. To repeat, what's done here is the correlation of one high PT track with the reaction plane from the rest of the event. Now, if your calculation is right, the reaction plane for all these centralities is entirely biased by the diejet.
Okay, you say that, first of all, you say that both methods that you use are identical.
The V2, once we extract the diejet component, so in the two-particle correlation, we can do both.
Okay.
This is the so-called reaction plane method. Okay, now we come to we come to this method where we look at the correlations nearby in eta and far from eta. And the correlations far from eta give a V2 entirely consistent with the reaction plane method.
So if we consider only two particle correlations, both methods are identical, simply mathematical arguments.
The two particle correlations have both a jet component, which is what you should predict, and a non-jet elliptic flow. I think this explicitly shows that there's a non-jet elliptic flow component, which you need to explain. I don't see how you can, because your correlations are entirely due to digets.
Go, we'll probably talk later.
I would like to... I have one question on this. I would like to ask you one question concerning this near-angle correlation. Did you try to, the best way how to figure out or disentangle the source of this near-angle correlation would be to study the centrality dependence and to see whether the yield of that guy somehow scaled with the number of...
Yeah, this is for the most central bin. We simply don't have the statistics for this. We certainly looked at that. We see the same phenomenon for more peripheral bins, but it's simply not the same level of precision. So that will have to wait till year two analysis.
If you have the double if you have the signal should become much larger.
Yes.
And you don't see that.
I don't know whether we have enough statistics to tell at the moment. I mean, it should in the limit it should go to what? Limit it should go to this, right? In the limit, I mean, this is UA1 is the ultimate peripheral collision. So. No, this is basically a measurement of the fragmentation function.
Because there's a lot of other soft contribution, and we observe a significant suppression of the hard scattering.
But Brian, what's the correlation between, if there is jet quenching, what's the correlation between quenching and this phenomenon? There's not necessarily one. If the jet fragment's outside the matter.
You showed in fact that there's no difference between quenching and not quenching.
In the current, right. In Huygens' current manifestation, but
right.
that's
simply a reflection of you're measuring angle separations instead of relative PTs, right? And that delta angle is purely a result of the soft KT scale in the jet fragmentation. So it should be independent of quenching.
Peter, can you comment? I thought you have analyzed this so-called V2 in terms of two particle and four particle cumulative method, and how they differ and why they are same.
So there's yet another way to attack this question of azimuthal asymmetries, and this is. By looking at four particle correlations where you can extract a quantity which is basically the same as this V2, there's a danger of two particle correlations contributing also to this reaction plane method where the four particle correlation is less sensitive to that. And in fact, if you do that four particle correlation, you get a value of V2 which is about 15% lower, which is actually basically where you see the systematic error bars here. However, it only goes up to about 3.5 or 4 GeV with rather large error bars, so we don't show it on the same plot.
If your reaction plane was biasing if the jet was biasing your reaction plane, you should see a V1 coefficient. Do you see V1 coefficients?
Extremely small. This was done some time ago. It's of order a couple of percent at most.
I was going to suggest you said at some point that you were just could take care of the trigger bias when comparing with your data. I think it would be much easier for you to correct for the trigger bias than for us to consider it.